Now more than ever. Lowe's knows you don't just want a low price. You want the lowest price. And with our lowest price guarantee, you can count on us for competitive prices on all your home improvement projects. If you find a qualifying lower price somewhere else on the same item, we'll match it. Lowe's. We help. You save. Price match applies to same item, current price at qualifying retailers. Exclusions and terms apply. Learn how we'll match price at lowes.com/lowest price guarantee.
I'm John Batchelor, visiting with Ben Crenshaw, who's an instructor at the Declaration of Independence Center at the University of Mississippi in Oxford, Mississippi, as well as a student and PhD candidate at Hillsdale College in Southern Michigan for politics. And Ben reminds us all very helpfully that we're coming to a anniversary of the Constitution. In the Constitution are many chambers, and we're going to enter one chamber, which can be described as the legitimacy barrier. This is to convince citizens who are virtuous, we'll assume that, that they have a voice in a vast republic or a small republic. And the legitimacy barrier in the Constitution, if I follow your case carefully, Ben, is between the federal government in Washington, D.C., and the state governments in the capitals. And that is the legitimacy barrier. What is the challenge of it, Ben? And then we'll get to the constitutional grain. Barrier first. What is it?
Yeah, so there is, you know, this was one issue with the authors that I was seeking clarity, because there's this common way of thinking in American political life and rhetoric to talk about the distinction between the private and the public sphere. And the private sphere is that of the family and business and civic institutions and education and so forth, kind of civic society, the engine of, you know, prosperity and GDP and so forth. And then there's the public sphere, which is politics. So there's a division between the private and the cultural and the public and the political. And the whole idea is that politics is cordoned off into this public sphere of limited function, limited reach, and so forth. So if the federal government starts kind of jumping that barrier and invading your, say, dictating what parents can teach their children, or you know, whether or not there should be some kind of transgender sex ed in you know, local public schools, and whether or not parents can take their kids out of that, and so forth. These are the issues that come up when we talk about this barrier. And my argument to Hale and Landy is that you know, there is a tradition there of the distinction between the private and the public, the culture and politics. But for the founding generation, the distinction was really more between the national powers of the federal government and the state governments. So basically, this whole structure of the Constitution is that the state governments precede the formation and function of the national government. So if you read somebody like Joseph Story in his 1833 commentaries on the Constitution of the United States, Story will argue, and he does so correctly, that you cannot have in the original, you know, understanding of the national government, you can't have a Senate, which is the upper chamber of Congress. You can't have a Senate without the state governments first, because the state governments were originally responsible for selecting and choosing senators. That was, of course, done away with in the 20th century when we went to a majority vote on that. But as well as the president, he couldn't function without the state government. So the state governments are actually more foundational. The states were seen as kind of like mini republics. And so the states had kind of plenary power to legislate, to rule, to govern for the well-being, the common good of their people in all of their lives. So this was known as the police powers, the powers to oversee and regulate morals, speech issues, religion, business, and family and marriage law, and so forth. And the states did all of this in quite a lot of detail in the 18th and 19th centuries. And then the states and the people of the states delegated a certain part of their political power to the national powers to say the national government is going to have these few great national objects of delegated power to rule kind of in a grand way over all the states and their collective understanding and the kind of the collective well-being, all the things that the states themselves could agree to, and that there needed to be some kind of sovereign over the states, because otherwise you would have the states bickering and fighting with each other. And John Jay goes through this quite well in the first few Federalist Papers. So the barrier is the national government versus states government, not so much politics being public versus the private life. The issue here is that what's known as incorporation of the Bill of Rights through the 14th Amendment in the early 20th century, you basically had the national powers kind of commandeer the state powers and tell the states that they had to govern according to the national constitution. So now in a state case, you can appeal, some local matter to your state Supreme Court, and then from there to the national Supreme Court and say, well, you're violating my, this local person or this local chapter or this local business, they're violating my First Amendment free speech rights. Well, the First Amendment applies only to Congress. Congress cannot do this. But originally, the states could regulate speech and they could regulate religion and so forth. So the legitimacy barrier has gotten muddled and confused. And to actually get back to what the founders thought about would require undoing a lot of the legal entanglements and morass, this kind of jurisprudential Gordian knot of the 20th century.
I want to make sure, Ben, I want to make sure we get to constitutional grain. So
yes. That's a description of the legitimacy barrier.
All right. We have a few minutes here. The constitutional grain, which Mr. Hale and Mr. Landy, I presume from reading your presence of them, it has positives, but the idea is that though the language is not in the Constitution, we're moving in the same fashion that the grain of the Constitution. Is that how to understand it? We have 2 minutes.
That's right. They're using a metaphor from carpentry, which is, when you cut a piece of wood, you want to cut it with the grain. That makes for an easier cut and a smoother cut and so forth. And they're saying, look, we could just follow the letter of the Constitution. But if we do that, we're boxing ourselves into this kind of strict constructionism or maybe even an originalist interpretation of the Constitution. And we could technically follow the written letter, the rule of the law, but miss the spirit, the purpose, the overarching things. And of course, this is what's happened in many ways because in the early, it was the late 19th century, the Supreme Court declared that the preamble of the Constitution was non-justiciable, which means no major legal or constitutional question could be decided on the basis of a reading of the preamble of the Constitution. And so what we end up happens then is this kind of very technical analysis of the procedures and the strictures of all the different clauses and parts, sections of the Constitution, but we miss the whole purpose of why those things exist. Why does the separation of powers and checks and balances exist? Well, it's because we want to establish, a more perfect union and tranquility and justice and the blessings of liberty outlined in the preamble. And so what Hale and Landy are doing, which is good, is
saying
that—
We have 1 minute, Ben, 1 minute.
Yeah. We have to get back to a larger understanding of this constitutional grain and allow ourselves a more expansive way of thinking constitutionally. I completely agree with that. My only hesitation is that you're just going to run into, I think that that's actually what President Trump is trying to do in terms of, say, firing certain executives within the
30 seconds, Ben.
The executive branch, yep. And, say removing illegal aliens, he's going to run into resistance from the kind of conservative legal establishment. So I highly recommend the book. I think it's a great overview of these things. You can go read it if you have more questions about the specifics.
Ben Crenshaw for the reviewing at Civitas Outlook, Keeping the Republic, Dennis Hale and Mark Landy. And Mr. Franklin's question remains open. You have a republic if you can keep it.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 million protection package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.